Okay, well, firstly, I've got to announce a minor change of plans. The original plan for today was to have a UML image to allow those of you with laptops to do a install of SE Linux while I'm doing the talk. Unfortunately, I just couldn't get UML working properly at all. I was having many segvs of it, and so I just had to cancel that idea. So I'm going to talk through what has to be done to install SE Linux. If if you have a laptop in the audience and you want to install SE Linux on your laptop, you can go through in the same order. I don't think we have network access here, but if you go out during the break halfway through, download the files, you can then install as we go through. Or, of course, you can just make notes and install at your leisure. So because of this, I'll start off with the order in which you install SE Linux. Firstly, you'd have to build or obtain an SE Linux kernel. Later on, I'll cover what SE Linux is and how it works. So I'll start with the beginnings. So for SE Linux, you have to enable the config security option to enable SE Linux and other security systems. You have to enable config security capabilities. If you don't, a common mistake is to skip this option. If you do, then you'll notice that bind doesn't work. The capabilities option doesn't seem to provide the full capabilities functionality. Some of the capabilities functionality is in the kernel regardless. What it is needed for is to enable an application to drop capabilities. And bind 9, when it starts off, it binds to port 53 and then it drops that capability and some other capabilities. These system calls will fail if you don't enable the capabilities option and bind won't start. This was very recently, a Sun employee released a set of COBOL kernel images to run SE Linux, and he made the mistake of not enabling capabilities. So this kernel image will run fine for SE Linux. Most of the stuff will work the way you want, apart from bind 9. Then, of course, you have to enable SE Linux, of course. The next option is SE Linux development mode. With SE Linux, it can be a little bit tricky to set up for the first time, and it's not uncommon for someone to make a mistake and give a file the wrong label and thus deny themselves access to it. Development mode means that by default the kernel will boot in permissive mode. This means that SE Linux will just log what it would do, but not actually do it. So it'll say, I'm going to prevent process A from accessing file B, and this is the context of the process, this is the type of the file, but it won't actually do it. And so this means that if you have something wrong, your machine will still boot up, still be able to log in and fix the problem, and it'll just tell you what the problems are. Another feature is the SE Linux MLS, multi-level security. This is one I recommend you turn off. One reason is that when you compile MLS into the kernel, you have to compile all the applications with support for it as well, and by default they're not compiled with it. Another issue is that currently no one is testing MLS, and I think that even the NSA guys aren't really doing anything with it. So you can probably expect that if you enable MLS, basically nothing will work. Now the next thing you have to enable is XAdder support. The new SE Linux uses extended attributes to store security context. Can I show of hands, who knows what an XAdder is? Okay. XAdder is a new feature in Linux, which is implemented in ext2 and ext3 file systems in 2.6. Support in XFS is about to go in. It enables extended attributes for files. This extended attribute is a pair of a textual name and some arbitrary data. So any application can then store extra data for a file under its own name. This is fairly similar to EAEs under OS2 or resource forks under the Macintosh system. Now, with SE Linux, we have a special XAdder, security.se Linux, which is used for storing the type of a file. I'll go back to that later. And also, of course, when you're configuring the kernel, you have to enable XAdders for devpts. Otherwise, you won't be able to get the correct labels on the terminal devices. When you're building the kernel, you also have to avoid using some other security modules which will conflict. So you don't want to install, you don't want to configure OpenWall, DCE, or LIDS. If you want to get kernel binaries, they're available on net right now. For Fedora, Arjan is building kernel packages with Xlinux support. That's for 2.6 kernels. I've got the URL there for the kernel and also for the utilities you need. Most of these utilities are now in Fedora, so if you download these and you're using Fedora Core 2, you'll find that most of the utilities are actually already in Fedora with newer versions. But there are, I think, one or two things that aren't up to the versions needed for 2.6. So Arjan's site is still good for that, and of course for the kernel package. Arjan's kernel has support for SE Linux built in, and the plan is for Fedora Core 2 to have a SE Linux enabled kernel by default, as with Red Hat Enterprise Linux 4. Enterprise Linux 4, which will be released about the end of this year, will have full SE Linux support, and the idea is when you put the first install CD in, one of the first questions they'll ask you is, do you want SE Linux, yes or no? If you choose yes, then you get the SE Linux kernel, etc., and the utilities installed. If you say no, then you'll get much like Enterprise Linux 3, but with newer versions of things. For Debian, I've put a set of kernel packages that I use to my own machines online. I don't plan to maintain a kernel binary archive for Debian. Brian May's been doing this for Woody. Brian, is Brian in the audience? No? Okay. I'm not sure whether Brian's still maintaining this. As I mentioned before, I'm not planning to continue maintaining Debian kernel packages. I just put these online as a one-off thing for those of you at the conference to if you want to try it out. Finally, Herbert Zhu is considering SE Linux for the official Debian 2.6.1 kernels. The reason for this is there was a recent feature added to the SE Linux kernel code to enable an extra kernel boot parameter to totally disable SE Linux functionality. If you have SE Linux fully configured and running, there is a slight performance overhead. It's between about 0.5% and 5% depending on what operations you're doing. So for some operations, 5% is annoying. It's not really a big deal, I think. I think if 5% performance hit will kill you, then you've probably got bigger problems than that. But you don't really necessarily want to lose 5%. If you have an SE Linux kernel with the SE Linux module enabled, but no policy loader, so SE Linux isn't actually doing anything, you get about half the performance loss, maybe about 2.5% performance hit in the worst case. If you use the kernel option to say, don't enable SE Linux at all, and that means that once you've booted, you can't re-enable SE Linux. If you use this option, then the performance hit is so small it's hard to measure. It's less than 0.5% under all tests, I think. So this is what got SE Linux as the default feature for the Fedora kernel, and is what made I think made the Herbert decide to put in for Debian, because a user who doesn't want it can just say no on the kernel command line, and they won't be hurt by it. Now the next thing you have to do is to get patched applications for SE Linux. For Fedora, Dan Walsh of Red Hat is providing patch applications. I've got the URL there. For Debian Unstable, I've got an apt line. That's the one I maintain myself. And for Debian Woody, there's an apt line of Brian May's repository of backports of the Unstable packages. Incidentally, the backports are backports of the Debian Unstable packages with SE Linux. They're not backports of SE Linux functionality to the old versions of the packages. So if you use Brian's backport repository, you'll get the newer versions of Core Utils and PAM and other things than you'll have in Woody. Okay, what is SE Linux? It's a system for mandatory access control based on the Linux Security Modules framework. For a show of hands, who knows what Mac is? Oh, I've got a few people. Okay. Mac is a system whereby the administrator has the control over what access is granted to files and other resources. Unix permissions that we're all familiar with are known as discretionary access control, abbreviated to DAC. This means that any user can use a chmod command to grant access to their files and directories. And I'm sure you're familiar with systems where the administrator has a cron job to do chmod 700 on all users' home directories, because the users don't really know about Unix, and they do chmod 777 on the home directories, and all sorts of problems occur as a result. With SE Linux and with other managed access control schemes, the administrator can control these things and say, for example, the user can't change permissions of their home directory. Another feature of SE Linux is it uses role-based and domain type access control. Domain type is the most commonly used form of discretionary access control, whereby every process has a domain assigned to it. Every file, directory, socket, other resource that a process can access has a type assigned to it. And you have a database mapping domains to types and determining what access is to be granted, whether access is to be granted or denied, and whether the access is to be audited. So for SE Linux, we can the default is to deny everything and audit the fact it's been denied. For some operations, you want to deny it and not audit it. For example, if you run ps command, it will look through the proc directories for all processes in the system. And every user will run ps hundreds of times a day. And we don't want to have, for every time they run ps, have one audit log entry for every single process on the system they're not allowed to see. You might have, say, 100 processes they're not allowed to see, so you have 100 log entries. Multiply that by 100 times running PS a day, and your logs get full. So you say, OK, don't audit these particular operations. Another option, of course, is you can allow an operation and audit it. So for operations that are important to the security of a system, such as loading a new policy database, or changing the machine between permissive and enforcing modes, these things can be logged even when they see. Role-based access control means that every user, when they log in, is assigned to a role, and that role then determines what domains they're permitted to use. So if they have a rule permitting them to enter a certain domain, and that domain isn't appropriate for their role, then they wouldn't be allowed to enter it. So for example, you have an administration role, which can be used to run all the administrative utilities, FDisk, user route, etc. And the domains for those utilities aren't permitted to be in the user role. Another feature of SE Linux is that it tracks user identity through all operations. One problem with regular Unix is that after a process has changed its UID, so for example, if you have a set UID root process that then calls the set UID system call to change another UID, it's virtually impossible to track who it was who initially ran the program. So, for example, if I was trying to crack a machine, I find a broken set UID root process. I exploit it to get the root user ID. Once I've done that, you can't tell where I came from. So what often happens when people are trying to debug problems with Unix machines, often not even security problems, often just problems of someone stuffed up something and we want to know who did it. You'll say, okay, what time did someone log in? They logged in 5 minutes before something went wrong. I'll just give them a hard time. They can be totally innocent, but that's all I can do. With SE Linux, the identity that they use to log into the machine is tracked through every operation, and they don't have it is impossible for them or any process they run to change the identity. Now, the overall aim of SE Linux is to remove the power of root. Who's familiar with my play machines? Okay. For about 2 years, I've been running SE Linux play machines on the net. I give everyone on the internet root access to the machine, let them do what they like, and I've only SE Linux to control the access. And so far, there have been a couple of minor bugs in SE Linux policy discovered. A lot of people have logged in and tried filling up disk space or doing other annoying things. but no one has actually cracked the machines. I had one script kiddie log in and send me an email asking for help installing a rootkit on my machine because he couldn't do it. That was rather amusing. The first thing he tried to do was copy a file to /dev, and that didn't work. Then he tried to copy a file to /sbin and /bin and a few other directories, none of that worked. Tried rming some things, didn't work either. Logged out, logged in again, tried the same thing again. They ran ID to verify there was actually root, and then sent me an email asking for help. And I thought it was a funny email, so I forwarded it to the guys at the NSA for a laugh. Yes, exactly. As I mentioned in the talk yesterday, if you log into my Play Machine, there is actually a full screen banner showing what's about. So I mentioned briefly what SE Linux is about. I mentioned why I'm running the Play Machine, so you can try cracking it and see that you can't. And I have my name at the bottom and saying, you know, if you have any problems, send me an email. This is the same email address I used to first entice the guy into trying to put his rootkit on there. Actually posted to Debian Devel saying, can someone help me put it on rootkit? So I replied and said, I can't help you put it on rootkit, but I know of a machine where you get root access. Here's the password. And after that, I thought, damn, I should have used a different email address, so he wouldn't have worked out it was me. But it didn't matter. He didn't read the mission of the day anyway, so. Anyway, there are also a few other SE Linux Play Machines online. There have been at least three that I know of at various times. One of them was actually compromised. Fortunately for the administrator, it was a friendly compromise, and the person who compromised just basically took over the administrative account, changed the password, and then went on IRC and said, hey, here's the new password for your machine, and told him how I did it. The mistake that this guy made was that he gave write access to his bash profile and bash RC files in his directory that he used for his own logins. So he'd log in and he'd run new role to change the administrative role to do administrative work. So what happened is this other user who had root access but no administrative role overwrote the bash RC file and put in a little macro named new role, which just sent the password out over the net via netcat. So he said to the guy, hey, could you just log in as administrator now? And the guy goes, oh, okay. Logs in, oh, it doesn't seem to work. And by the time he'd realized that there was a shell alias used to send the data out, the other guy had already captured the password, logged in, changed to the administrative role, changed the password, and owned the machine. I'm sorry? No. No. I was just an innocent passerby. I was on the IRC channel and someone said, hey, did you hear this other machine got owned? I go, oh, that's interesting. But fortunately, the two guys who were involved in this, the guy who was owned and the guy who did the owning, were actually acquaintances from previously. So the guy who owned the machine trusted the other guy. And then I said, look, all I did was change the password. Here's the new password. So he just changed the password to something else, and that was the end of it. Didn't have to go through the effort of reinstalling the machine, etc., because he actually trusted the guy. But I mean, obviously, someone else who is less nice could have done the same thing. There was one mistake I made in the early days of running Play Machines, a mistake that I was informed of within 24 hours of putting a machine on the internet. Actually, the first time I ran a Play Machine was at a Linux Tag conference in Germany. And because of there was only one machine, there were no terminals, everyone had to be at the console, it limited what they could do. One thing that someone found was that there was a bug in the policy at that time whereby they could read the WILO files in /boot. And they believe this could give them some access to possibly allow them to practice the machine. They never managed to prove this to be the case, but it is kind of suspicious. And if there was a WILO password for it, then they could have probably got the password too. So I changed the policy to fix that. But at that time, no one had tried doing anything with the shadow file. And I just sort of forgotten about the shadow file, because if you're root, then you can read the shadow file, and it had the same type as MC password, which everyone can read. So on the first day of putting an SLinux machine on the internet, someone made a copy of the shadow file and said, hey, you know, you shouldn't be allowing this. The reason why the policy didn't stop this is because SELinux, the NSA guys, when they designed SELinux, weren't designing it to run play machines and for giving root access to hostile people over the net. So every time I make an announcement, hey, I've got a new play machine online, I can immediately respond from the NSA guys saying, never, never do this. Not because they don't think the SELinux can handle it, just because you don't have just one level of security. If you want to be serious about security, you want to have several levels, and of course also you don't want to challenge people. But the aim of the play machines is it's a learning experience for everyone involved. A lot of the times I've had SELinux play machines offline, I merely get a lot of email from people saying, hey, you can put it online again. I want to install SELinux in my machine. I want to see how it's supposed to run properly. So one of the large reasons that for a play machine actually surprised me when I learned about it was people just want to log in and see an SELinux machine working properly, and so they can make their machine work the same. Because if you haven't used SELinux before, you don't know how it's supposed to work. It can be a bit daunting to get it going. If the machine is running properly, you can log in as root, read all the files, except for the shadow file and a few others. Then you get a good feel for what's needed to do it right. So anyway, the problem with the shadow file, I fixed that pretty quickly, just have a different type. Then, of course, there was the issue of changing the password. So I initially wrote there was already a password wrapper for some other reasons. So I changed this password wrapper and the policy for it so that the password program would by default create files in the shadow type, and then it would change the type of the password file, which for some reason it creates as well, back to the UC type, which everyone can read. Incidentally, does anyone know much about password utilities? Okay. One thing I've been trying to find out is why the password program even rewrites the password file. It seems to be that when you change a password, you don't change the password file. It doesn't seem to have any point. And it would be a lot easier for me if it didn't do so, but I'm hesitant to change things like that without knowing what they do and why they do it. Okay, SELinux is based around the LSM framework, that's the Linux Security Modules. This was developed development started, I think, sort of 3 years ago at the request of Linus. At the time, there was a number of different security frameworks that people were trying to get into the kernel. The NSA guys wanted SELinux and the Linux kernel. Hewlett Packard had their own security system, which seemed to have been deceased by now. But at the time, they were pushing and selling. And they wanted to have the kernel code, which is all GPL, into the main kernel. And I think there was Immunix. They had their own stuff they were working on at the time. I think there were some others as well. And so everyone was saying, hey, I want to get mine in the kernel. And all the requirements were somewhat similar, but a little bit different. And Linus said, look, I don't want to have three sets of kernel hooks or four sets of kernel hooks through this. Design a new framework with one set of kernel hooks that will work for all of these security modules, and so that any of these security modules can be operating with this framework, then come back to me. So LSM was developed because of this. I believe that a large part of the LSM development was funded by DARPA, and also some of the NSA guys developed a lot of it. Now it seems that LSM has virtually ended up as being the interface for SELinux. SELinux, I believe, is at the moment the only LSM module that actually works. So in the 2.6 kernel, there are some other modules, but as far as I know, or as of last time I tested at least, SELinux was the only one to compile. Now, LSM has a number of features that haven't been used much, a number of features that are still to be designed. One feature that people have been working on various times gets implemented and then gets broken by further changes, then they have to wait for it to be implemented again, is the feature of module stacking. Who here is familiar with OpenWall? Okay. OpenWall has a few small changes to the kernel to cater for special cases that are known dangerous cases. One example is making a symbolic link pointing to etc shadow and other files that you don't have read access to. Another example is if you run a setuid program and it has file handles 0, 1, and 2 not being open, then the kernel will open /dev/null those file handles. The reason for this is that there have been some attacks in the past whereby you run a setuid root program and you have it run with those file handles being closed. The setuid program then opens a file, like perhaps etc password, etc shadow or something, and then it does an operation with standard input or standard output. And it gets surprised that it finds it's reading from the wrong file. So perhaps it's reading from, instead of reading from standard input, it's reading from the shadow file, and then echoes the data to the terminal or something, and you get to read the shadow file. Or perhaps it's writing to a file that thinks it's standard output or standard error, but it's writing to the shadow file or password file, and it corrupts the system in that manner. So OpenWall does these things to just cater for corner cases. So, yes? GS Security does those things, yes. So GS Security, yes. GS Security, they have their own managed access control scheme that they're just developing, which is just being re-implemented to role-based security as well. I think that's not released in release stage yet. But also they do a lot of a lot of code to catch these corner cases. So in the case of the GR Security, the original GR Security features for catching corner cases and OpenWall features, having these and SE Linux would be good. SE Linux, question? Yeah, and they both work together? Oh yeah. But currently SE Linux doesn't work with OpenWall or GRSec functionality. So what we'd ideally like to have is have the OpenWall or GRSec functionality in terms of open file handles for setuid processes, for symlinks, etc., and have that enforced in addition to SE Linux. So one of the aims of LSM is to eventually support module stacking. So we can have a module like SE Linux, it's a heavyweight module to control access to all files in the system, then have a lightweight thing like OpenWall just catch a few corner cases that are hard to catch with a security policy for SE Linux. This has been written a few times and been broken a few times, and I believe it's still broken right now. But it's hopefully be done. Now, to get the SE Linux kernel code and the LSM code, the NSA ship a kernel patch that has SE Linux and LSM for 2.4 kernels. For 2.6 kernels, it's all in the kernel. To download 2.6.0 or 2.6.1 from ftp.kernel.org, it has everything you need. The NSA does distribute patches for 2.6, but they add extra functionality that wasn't in 2.4 SE Linux, and which is handy to have, but isn't strictly needed for 2.6 operation. So for example, on my machines, I'm running straight 2.6.1 with no patches. The NSA guys recommend running their patches for the extra functionality, but I find what I'm doing is easiest to just use an unpatched kernel. For my work on Fedora machines, I use Arjan's kernels, which I think sometimes have the NSA patches as well. I haven't actually checked the details of that. So. Okay, now what's wrong with discretionary access control? One of the first problems is programs have full control over the files they create. One example that springs to mind is a few years ago, IBM released a Java development environment that was very insistent on creating mode 777 files /tmp. And I did a hack to solve this problem, a LD preload hack. It intercepted the open create and mkdir system calls and just change the permissions on files and directories. It's pretty ugly. With SE Linux, you can specify that the type you use for files /tmp, and don't give other domains access to this type, and there's no problems at all. And also, with Another issue is the issue of setuid programs. So if you run a setuid process, it's going to have access to all the files from your user ID, as well as all the files from user ID setuid to. This isn't always desirable. For example, if you have a student lab, and you have a situation where you have one account that's being used for some centralized software, and you want to have setuid programs written by students that other students run, you don't really want to give these programs access to the files from the student who's running them, because they'll have all sorts of fun ripping off each other's files. With SE Linux, we have a domain automatic transition rule saying that when domain A runs a particular type B, it'll transition to domain C. And domain C might have no access to the files that domain A would have access to. You might even have access to the terminal device. So you have tight control over what it gets access to. And you can also grant arbitrary other access as necessary. Do we have any questions at this stage? Okay. Other problems with Unix security. It's too coarse-grained. Having only user IDs and groups for security really isn't enough to do what you want to do for a modern machine. It's okay for possibly for a home desktop machine, but for a university lab or for a large corporation, it's not going to work at all. Some people have been making changes to the kernel to support to have extra support for groups. One change was one patch that apparently floating around is to allow up to 300 or 400 supplementary groups. Currently with the kernel, you get the default of 32 supplementary groups maximum, and people want to have 300, 400 groups? Thousands? Okay. If you need to have 1,000 groups, then I think that for one user, then I think that probably your design is flawed. And with SE Linux, you can grant access on a per-file basis and say, this particular domain or set of domains access this type. And you don't have to try and force things in the groups when they weren't designed to do it. Yep. Do you have a group for each classroom or something? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, now another problem with Unix security is that in many cases, it ends up as being almost a Boolean thing. Either you're root or you're not root. And this just really doesn't work. For example, everyone's familiar with the numerous security issues regarding the name server bind. Bind 9 now uses capabilities so it can drop someone's access. Previous versions of bind ran with full access all the time, so they ran as root. And this meant that if you exploited bind, you could run a shell as root, you could access any user's home directory, you could read and write the shadow file, it was unlimited. What we want to do with bind, we want to say, okay, it can use port 53 for TCP and UDP, it can read its configuration files, it can write to its cache files, and that's pretty much about it. So with this policy for bind, that's all it is allowed to do. So if you have an SE Linux machine and someone cracks your name server, they can, of course, send bogus DNS responses, which can be annoying and could lead to other security issues, but they can't read the shadow file, they can't run any further damage to a machine. So if you have an SE Linux machine running bind and bind is cracked, all you have to do is kill the old version of bind, install a patched version, restart it, and problem solved. And the same technique is used for every other daemon. For this Linux policy, your policy for every daemon in the system, and they will specify what access it gets. And the access is designed to be the minimum required for operation. Okay, what does MAC provide? It provides a strong separation of security domains. So by default, different domains have no interaction committed at all. They can't access the same files. They can't see each other in a PS listing or anything else. We have fine-grained control of resources. For every type of file in the system, you can specify for each domain whether it can read the file, write the file, do a get header operation on the file for an ls-l. And there is a possibility to configure things such that a user can run suset programs in different domains. I haven't actually written policy for this yet. There hasn't been much demand. It's a more advanced feature. But there are some users who've been asking me about this. And they want to have a system, a multi-user system, where every user has, say, two roles. One role for doing email, running GPG, SSHing other machines with SSH private keys, other important things. Another role for running programs that are suspected of being hostile. For example, if someone sends you a script and says, hey, this is a new exploit for SSHD. What's that? What do you mean? Oh, yes. But the recent exploit for SSHD, as far as I can determine, didn't actually exploit SSHD at all. All it did, it made a token connection to the SSHD and did some stuff just to look like it was doing a job. And in the meantime, also, it would say it needs root access, refuse to run if it's not root. And so you run it as root, it connects to the SSHD, does some stuff which did no good at all, reads your shadow file, emails it off somewhere on the net, and sends information on IP addresses of all interfaces, a copy of the password file, of course, output of who, and a few other interesting things. And it was rather amusing, actually, when this one came about, because heaps of people were saying this works, or saying that it seems to work. So I ran it on my play machines. So I ran it with a normal exploit on play machine. Incidentally, this is another thing you can do on my play machines if you like. If you get a suspect exploit, and you don't want to run your own machine, run on a play machine. I'm happy with that. It's not going to do any damage. The worst it could do is log you out of my play machine, prevent you logging back in. In which case, you go to IRC and tell me about it, and I'll fix it up. Anyway, so I ran this, and it sent an email. But I've configured my play machine to not allow port 25 connections to any mail server other than mine, for obvious reasons, otherwise people will be spamming through it. So I see this email in the queue going to an address in a German ISP. So anyway, all people are saying, oh, I've run this exploit. I said, well, actually, all it does is get your shadow file, etc., and send it to a German ISP. And I said, no, it doesn't. So I go, okay. So I reconfigure my mail system to... So I reconfigure my mail system to send this particular email, instead of to a German ISP, send it to me. So it goes to me, then I forward it to the list in question. And so, okay, guys, this is the email that it sends out. It hasn't got the shadow file because I don't allow access to the shadow file. But when I run the script, it audits a read attempt on the shadow file. So presumably, if I wasn't running SE Linux, it would have sent a shadow file as well. But it just gives a password file and everything else we can get. And so this isn't something you want to run on the machine you own. And everyone's like getting a bit scared then. Fortunately, on the same mailing list, there was someone who worked for that associated company with that ISP. So about 20 minutes later, the account in question was cancelled, and the person who was exploring the exploit was obviously very disappointed, I guess. But, I mean, I imagine that person would have got, you know, 1,000 root accounts on the machines, at least. It was a very well-known exploit. Among other things, they'd encrypted somehow, or presumably XOR or something simple, the string shadow. So if you run strings on the binary, you wouldn't see any reference to shadow or password or anything else that looked suspicious. So they've done a reasonable attempt, I think. Okay, then the next issue is patched applications. This is an important difference between SE Linux and other systems such as GRSec and RSBAC. I think that the way GRSec's going, they might do something similar to SE Linux in the near future. But RSBAC has a stated aim of not having patch applications. This aim could be achieved with SE Linux with different policy, but the way that the default policy for SE Linux, you're required to have patched applications. The reason is you want to track the identity of the user right throughout the session. So this means the login process has to assign the identity to the shell. So what we need to do is have initially for SE Linux, there was a patch login program. Recently, Dan Walsh from Red Hat wrote a PAM module, PAM-SELinux.so, and this module does all that's needed. So it checks the user's name against the security policy database to see if they have an identity compiled in. Incidentally, there's three categories of identities in this SELinux policy. There's the system underscore u identity, which is system processes, daemons. There's the user u identity. This is for users who don't have the identity compiled in the database. Prior to the introduction of that, every time you added a new user, you had to change your SE Linux policy database, recompile it, and load it in the kernel. And that was kind of annoying. And also, of course, if you have, say, 10,000, 20,000 users on the machine, you might not want to have 20,000 entries in the user's file in SE Linux compiled into the policy database. So you can have user u being a default for users who don't have any other identity. Or, of course, you could deconfigure this if that's what you wish. So, all configurable, of course. And the main class of identities is where identity matches username. So, for example, I log into my Play machine using my account name RJC, migate identity RJC. This identity then permits me to use the staff underscore R role and the sysadm underscore R role. And so when I log in via SSH, I log in into the staff role. After a SSHD exploit about year and a half, 2 years ago, we changed the default SE Linux policy to not permit administrative logins via SSH by default. So the default policy for SE Linux currently, if you log in via SSH as your administrative account, you will not have the administrative role. So therefore, you need to run the new role command and enter your password to authenticate yourself to obtain the administrative role. This means, for example, if right now while I'm giving this talk, if they find a SSHD exploit, SSHD bug that's exploitable, someone can crack SSHD on one of my machines and they can't get the administrative account. This means that if I then go home, log in at the console, I can fix the SSHD without any risk of the administrative account being compromised. Now, so then if you want to log in as administrator, you've got to log in as a staff role and then run the new role command to change the administrative role. Yep. Of course, yep. If someone owns a machine you're running the SSH client on, you've lost already. Yeah. So this means that mainly you just have to have good passwords. And use. Yep. There's no reason why not. OTP might not work right now, because I've never tried doing it. As far as I know, the NSA people haven't done it. I don't know of anyone else who's used OTP with SE Linux. So I suspect that it wouldn't work out of the box right now, because it would have to write some data somewhere saying, I've used password 1, and we'll use password 2 next. and the login /bin/login and SSHD aren't given permissions to write to any of the places they might want to write such a file. So this means that it wouldn't work just because Torvalds has been written for it. If you had a, if you install SE Linux and OTP on a machine, and then send me the log messages, within about 5 minutes, I'll give you a policy that'll work with it. Yep. Well, for some meanings of bad. Exactly, yes. I mean, if you have a host on the internet that, for some bad reason, has your GPG secret key on it, and a SSH private key used to authenticate, that's used to allow login to other machines, and someone logs in as that account, the results will be pretty bad. There are some mitigating factors, however. In the default policy, I have a policy for GPG that prevents the user from directly reading their own GPG private key file. However, what you can, GPG of course can read it, so you can instruct GPG to encrypt its own secret key file with password 1234, and once you've got that file, you can then decrypt it again and get the secret key file. I talked to Werner about this, and he thinks it's a good idea to change GPG to not allow such things. And that was about a year ago, and he hasn't done it yet, but I think it's still somewhere on his to-do list, so hopefully we'll soon this problem will be fixed. Yep. It would just be a matter of permitting new role to write a file in some location that does whatever OTP does. I've never used OTP, so I'm not sure exactly what it does, but I imagine you write some file to say which passwords are being used. Yep. It does use PAM. Yep, use PAM. Yep. We just had to allow writing to a particular file. So, yes. Now, in the SE Linux policy, when you define a domain, you can define attributes for it. And so then you have rules granting access to various attributes rather than to domains directly. So, for example, we have an attribute auth underscore cfkpwd, and that permits a domain to authorize a user by running the Unix underscore chkpwd program. Now, we could have a Unix underscore chkpwd program that does OP stuff, have the same file type assigned to the file, and then all we have to do is enable the domain for that particular program to write to the correct file. Incidentally, one thing I don't want to do is to grant a .so file or code an .so file for OP to directly write to the OP file. I don't allow that at all. I don't want to allow /bin/login and SSHD to read the shadow file or to directly interact with any other authentication information. All I want them to do is to get a password, pass it to another program, and another program does whatever is appropriate to authenticate the user. And that way, if you compromise SSHD, you can't get the passwords or anything else of use. For login, it probably doesn't matter too much. But after doing it for SSHD, doing it for login was no extra work, so there's no point not doing it. I mean, also, I imagine there's some conceptual possibility of someone compromising a login program and having access to the console of the machine when no one's watching, etc. Although that's much less likely. But it's good to cover all bases. Well, it'll be just as secure as the shadow file in that regard, and we still don't want to give read access to the shadow file. The advantage of OP, I guess, is it's automatically generated passwords, so the passwords aren't going to be as crap as normal passwords. If you allow a user to choose their own password, at least a third of users will choose absolutely appalling passwords. For OP, I think it's all just random number generated passwords. Is that correct? Yep. Oh yes. So in the password you type in if you're using OPI. Well, yeah, that's still bad. If you allow the user to generate their own passwords, then you don't want to allow the encrypted file to be read, because all you got to do is run dictionary attack. Yes, but if someone can read the MD5 file and say, I think the user's password is fish, and do an MD5 encryption of fish and see if it is. Yes, but the MD5 hash of it is. No? Yep. Yes. Yep. So I want to protect against these sort of attacks. So for the same reason as for a shadow file, we want to not allow the login post to read it. But this is an easy thing to fix. I mean, it probably perhaps an hour's work for me to get OPI working properly on SE Linux if I get OPI installed and running. So I figure that I'd probably have to change the PAM module for it, because it probably wouldn't do quite what I would like it to do. If I wanted to just write new policy and have it doing what it currently does, it'd be 5 minutes work for me. There's not an answer. It'll be done sooner or later. Chances are that even if I don't get around to doing it myself, someone at Red Hat will say, our customers need to have OPI and you've forced me to do it in a hurry, so it'll get done eventually. Any other questions related to such things? Yes? Very good question. I'll cover that while I move on. Core utils has to be patched to allow LS to show the file context, and CP and MV CP and MV have the option of preserving the file context. It's a slightly problematic one, of course, because you would hope that the context will be preserved, but in many cases not permitted. So if you, for example, move a file from your home directory to the source directory, it might not be permitted for you to have be anything else than the source underscore T type. That's a matter of policy. For CP, the default should be to not preserve context and just take the default context for the directory you're copying it to. But there's an option to preserve the context. Currently, the Debian package of core utils is actually broken, and it will try and preserve context in the wrong way on both CP and MV. There's two ways of doing this. One way is to copy the context after you've created the file. The other way is to assign the context, say to the system, for the next file I create, I want to use this context and create it with a different context. And these operations are both slightly different. And a final twist is that when you label a file system initially, every file has an identity on it, the identity of being the identity of the user who created the file. When you initially label a file system, every file has system underscore u as the identity, so it's created by the system. So this is when you do an initial install of the system, or when you first install SE Linux. So just say, I want to copy a file from USR shared doc to my home directory. Fairly common operation. So I copy it to my home directory. When I create a file, if I'm going to assign the context to it, I can only assign my own identity. I can't assign someone else's identity to a file. So CP in Debian will erroneously try and assign system underscore u context, and that will be denied. Now, the question was asked, do you have to do the same things for tar? The answer is, ideally, yes. There is a patch for star to do this. As far as I know, there is no patch for GNU tar at the moment. There was a patch, but the patch was widely regarded as being too ugly. The upstream maintainers of GNU tar said, this isn't the way it should be done, it should be done in some other way. And so the only thing everyone agreed on was that the patch in existence wasn't suitable, and no one's written a better patch since. If someone's looking for an interesting coding project to apply to SE Linux, patching GNU tar would be a good thing to do, I think. You would learn a lot about Unix coding and tar, etc., because the code that is pretty wild. As for gzip, well, I'll get your question in a second. It was asked whether gzip also needs to be patched. I don't think so. Well, actually, no. There are two ways of operating gzip. One way is compressing from send input into send output. In that case, there's no security stuff related to it. If you want to do a file on disk, then the way it will currently work is it will take the default context of the directory. And it is just going to be, you're right, it would probably be good to have it preserve the same context of the file. Sometimes the context of a file doesn't match the context of a directory. So it should be a good feature to have in gzip. Yes, absolutely. You don't want to get back. Well, actually, getting to exactly where you started from wouldn't always be possible. For example, if I have a file that's got identity system underscore u from a new install machine, I gzip compress it. It has my own identity RJC. I decompress it. I can only use my own identity RJC. So in that case, it wouldn't be possible to get back to exactly where you start from. In terms of access to the file for read, write, etc., then the result will be the same if it's permitted to preserve the type, which may not be possible. If I compress a file that has, say, probably a good example. In default policy, there aren't any good examples of this, but you can write a policy whereby a user can read a file and unlink it, which is needed for a gzip compress operation, but they can't write to that file or file type or create a file of that type. In which case, you could compress it, but the compressed file couldn't have the same type. In which case, gzip should ideally produce a warning, standard error saying, I couldn't reserve the context, and then when you decompress it, you get the same resulting context. Now, I had a question back there. Good question. If you tar a directory at one part of the file system and untar it somewhere else, what context do you get? Because it's unpatched, you get the default context for the directory where you untar it. So, for example, I'm a regular user on the machine. I tar up something under /usr/share/doc. It has type usr underscore t, but tar doesn't know this. So then I untar it under /tmp. I'm logged in as user underscore r role with user underscore t domain. That's for an unprivileged regular user. So any file I create under /tmp has the type user underscore tmp underscore t. So therefore, all these files that used to be usr underscore t, when I untar them, will have usr underscore t, tmp underscore t. Okay, any more questions? Yes? Dump should, I'm not saying it does, I'm saying should, preserve all extended attributes of a file and all other file system metadata. So therefore, when you do a restore from dump, you should have all this data restored, including the file context. Because a program doesn't have to know about SE Linux as such to preserve the context. All it has to do is preserve the exatters. So it has to preserve the security.selinux, etc. So dump will ideally do this, because it will ideally back up everything and restore everything. And so, therefore, there shouldn't be any problems. But I don't know. Yes. However, the problem is that you sometimes can't restore them quite the same because of the identity issue. So therefore, that's why I believe star was patched. I haven't looked at the code, but I believe the reason for the star patch was so it could say, oh, I can't use system underscore identity, so I'll ask the system, I'll ask the kernel, what identity can I use? And you'll say, you can use this identity, and it'll try the new context, and it'll work. Okay, is this time for a break now? I'll take one more question, then we'll have a break. Oh, very good question. The question was, do you have any problems with the shell, because there's a lot of file error, etc. It's ongoing issues. The annoying thing is, Bash, I mean, there are different shells, of course, Bash does everything. It looks at a heap of files in /proc. It wants to use /dev/tty when other processes will just use /dev/whatever, or /dev/pds or something. It does a lot of stuff. And this means that when you're writing policy for a domain, if you have a domain that doesn't run a bash script, the policy can be very simple. And then the upstream makes one minor change. They change it from a Perl script to a bash script. And you'd think that's a nothing change. And then suddenly you have to read in all of proc and everything, and you have to add about 10 rules. It's kind of annoying. No, not at all. Well, I mean, does reading /proc/meminfo cause any problems with security? I don't think so. This is the kind of stuff it does. It's low-level stuff. You can't have it just the default rules apply, which is deny it and audit it, because your logs get full with stuff that means nothing, and that's bad for security. So you have to either put in a don't audit or an allow, and things like proc/meminfo, I think that you might as well just allow it, because it might do some good, and I'm hesitant to do don't audit, because one thing that it can really bite you is you think, well, I don't really need this, I just put in a don't audit. And then a year later, something's not working quite right, and there's nothing audited. You think, damn, what's going on here? So then you turn off all auditing in the system, and you get hundreds and hundreds of messages going through a second, and then you find that one message you put in a don't audit for a year ago because you didn't think you need it. So I'm kind of hesitant to put in these don't audit things. So for things like Bash, I put in a bunch of allowables I wouldn't otherwise put in. Yep. I think now's a good time to break. So we're back in 30 minutes' time.